Mr. Baronato.
I believe I reserved 3 minutes, please.
Good. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, Court, throughout this case, Jacobs contested infringement up until pretrial. In the pretrial, they came into the pretrial conference and they admitted to rampant inflation, infringement of a number of claims. We've listed them in the brief. The Court discussed them in its opinion, and for reasons not particularly clear, it then decided to disregard them. And I want to make the point that at the pretrial conferences, we're criticized somewhat in our brief for not pointing to any kind of a transcript. There was no transcript. So it was just in chambers with the judge, there was no transcript, and Jacobs and Danaher admitted to infringement of a number of claims, including Claim 10. They admitted to infringement at the pretrial.
But he corrects that, right? He corrects that admission, right?
Never. No, in fact, they made the admission repeatedly during trial, and they made the admission during their pre-closing statements.
But Jacobs, if I understand the record, had contested the underlying independent Claim 9 throughout, and then went back and corrected its admission as to the dependent Claim 10. Basically correct as to the record?
Not correct, Your Honor. Claim 9 is...
Don't you just tell me it's not correct. You're going to have... Claim 9... The other side tells me it's absolutely
Claim 9 is a dependent claim. So Claim 9 is dependent upon Claim 6. What happened...
Which was contested all the way along.
No, Claim 6 was admitted. Okay. Claim 6 was admitted. They contested Claim 9. And they admitted to infringement repeatedly at pre-trial, during trial, and their post-closing arguments.
Where's the prejudice to you here?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, we go in trial and they admit to infringement. We're entitled to rely on admissions. There's no need for us to prove facts that are not in dispute. And infringement is a finding of fact. In fact, at one point in his discussion, counsel for Jacobs, Mr. Klein, went on to discuss, you know, basically why are we showing valve flow, supercharging, etc., when those are not material to any issue involving infringement. And so, therefore, we were prejudiced by the fact that we changed our trial strategy, if you will, on the eve of trial due to Jacobs' admission.
I don't understand how you can say that Claim 10 isn't dependent on Claim 9. It says the apparatus as claimed in Claim 9.
No, I'm sorry. I believe Judge Rader said it was independent Claim 9, and I said Claim 9 is dependent upon Claim 6.
But
Claim 10 is dependent.
They were contesting Claim 9 all the way along.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Claim 10 is dependent on Claim 9.
Claim 10 is dependent upon Claim 9. That's correct. And so they admitted to claim infringement of Claim 10.
They made a mistake, and the judge allowed them to correct it.
Well, but we were not allowed to correct it. We were not allowed to correct it. They admitted to it at the pretrial. They admitted to it repeatedly during the trial. They admitted to it in their post-closing arguments. In fact, Mr. Mead, in his post-closing arguments, said, "Let me check to make sure I'm not making a mistake." He goes on and recites the particular
point. But the admissions here come at the close of trial after you've made all your arguments and they've made all theirs, right?
That's not correct. They made it in the pretrial, and they made it repeatedly during trial. Repeatedly during trial, they said, "We admit that we infringe." And we come here, Mr. Coyne says, it's a big admission that we're making. He goes on and expounds about what a big deal it is. We're not fooling around. This is a major thing for us to do at trial. And let's move on validity. That was their thrust, was validity. And so therefore, we relied on that. We were shocked when the opinion comes out and the judge says, "Well, I'm deciding they made a mistake," because we were never informed of that. And, you know, if somebody had made a mistake in admission, certainly we should have been given an opportunity to respond, because we were not given that opportunity.
Can you, by the way, just show me in the record where it occurred in pretrial?
I can't, there's no record of the pretrial.
So we're going on your...
The judge himself cites to it. It says here, which is at A946, the judge says, "Let me ask you where we are here. When we spoke on Friday, which was January 5, 2006, after they had a pretrial, Jacob was prepared to concede infringement. We talked about the need for some evidence to evaluate, to enable me to evaluate the merits of the invention or lack of merit of the invention. So they made it at the pretrial. And then if you look at our brief on page 33 of our reply brief.
Well, but that's not specific to claim 10, is it?
Well, that particular portion is not. But the next portion...
Because they always conceded infringement of a number of things.
No, they did not always.
Oh.
Okay. It was at the pre-trial that they made that admission, Your Honor. And they continued it throughout the trial. But following up, in our brief, we point to where Mr. Coyne specifically said, Your Honor, in our view, none of this goes to anything that's material in the case because the issue of infringement on claims 10, we have conceded. We agreed with Your Honor at the final pre-trial conference. Our product works that way. So he's telling you that the pre-trial conference is conceded infringement of claim 10. He said our product works that way. And we were prejudiced because we were not entitled, we had no reason to contest that. They didn't contest it. It was not until after this opinion came out that all of a sudden claim 10 became in play from an infringement point of view.
Well, I don't see the prejudice because in order to show infringement of claim 10, you'd have to show infringement of claim 9.
Your Honor, I don't have to prove what's not in dispute. In claim 10, the infringement of claim 10.
No, but the question is how you're prejudiced. I mean, you, at the trial, you addressed claim 9, right?
We addressed claim 9.
And the jury found against you.
No, it was not a jury trial. It was a bench trial.
A bench trial, yeah.
Well, but there's nothing to find. This court the Calibrate case that we cite, specifically said it's an abuse of discretion for a court to ignore the admission that was made before the trial. And in Calibrate, in fact, the party admitted to infringement before the trial. They contested infringement during the trial, and the judge sent the case to the jury found non-infringement. This court reversed. There's no requirement of prejudice. It simply said, that's the decision, you made it. You're stuck with it. Sorry you made it. And that's the situation we have here.
Can I move you to another question, and that is, with respect to the claims that the district court found obvious, there are claim construction issues here. And it struck me that the claim construction issues, which you appear now to be trying to argue, were not argued below or, in fact, were conceded below. And can you show me, for example, where the delayed compression relief construction of Claim 1, for example, was argued below?
Well, in fact, that's exactly what the lower court found. The lower court found that it's a properly timed inverter.
No, that's not the question. The question is, did you argue this below?
We argued it. We did argue it. We cited to the testimony of the inventor that was made.
I want to see where you argued it as a question of claim construction, because it seems to me that one of the major differences between the parties is how to construe these claims for purposes of the obviousness analysis, and Mr. Coyne argues that you waived this, and I'm trying to find out whether you did waive it or not.
We argued it, Your Honor, Pates, when our reply brief, we pointed to the testimony of the inventor. We found that by timing significant.
What page are you on?
It's in the record 8305-308.
I don't think the inventor's testimony is a claim construction argument. Where did you argue this as a claim construction issue?
It never really came up with a claim construction.
Well, that's the problem.
Well,
yeah.
It may be a problem now, except it came out later, or the judge then changed the claim construction. What we argued throughout this was that the inventor had a properly timed engine brake operating with a properly set exhaust brake, with the result that you floated the valve on its intake stroke so that air flowed in to supercharge that cylinder. And the issue that the court looked at was, what does open mean? What's an open exhaust valve? and did the claim require airflow into the cylinder?
You're addressing a different issue, but let's turn to the trap charge and supercharging. It struck me in reading the record that you had conceded that the district court's view that those were not part of Claim 1 during the proceedings below. No?
We agreed that claim does not keep the claims, and I want to point out Claim 1 is a method claim. Claim 6 and Claim 11 are means plus function claims, so they're considered a little bit differently from a construction point of view. But what we conceded was that there's no express recitation in the claim of supercharging or trap charge. What we said was, if you do what is claimed, the necessary result of that is trap charge or supercharging, because you open that valve and you allow air to flow into the cylinder, so that when the piston starts on the following compression stroke, you have that increased charge, which gives you the performance gain that Mr. O'Neill found. And that's what we argued below, and the district court agreed. I think the parties all agreed that the proper construction, particularly of the apparatus claim with their means plus function, was a properly timed engine brake operating in combination with a properly set exhaust brake, so that you open the valve late on its intake stroke. And the court construed an open exhaust valve to mean one where air would flow into that cylinder. That's what the invention was all about. That's what Mr. Benioff found. And there's no prior art that this court had before that shows that combination. In fact, there's no testimony in the record about the combination which the district court relied upon to invalidate the claims. The district court relied on Okamura and Seiko, and you are welcome to peruse the record, but there is absolutely no testimony of any witness as to why that combination would be obvious.
But Okamura discloses, to some degree, all elements of Claim 1, right?
We disagree, Your Honor. We believe that Okamura, you have to pick and choose in Okamura. You can find little words here and there. Okamura, in fact, has what we call four embodiments. There's essentially two embodiments. There's one embodiment where he uses his special purpose third valve. The judge found that that was not an exhaust valve. Jacobs has not appealed that finding. He found that...
But the power retard uses the third valve, right?
They all did. What Okamura was one of a series of articles and patent applications by Mitsubishi on its power retard and retarder, which used that special purpose third valve. There was no...
One of these references, though, says that you could also use the exhaust valve.
Okamura says you can use an exhaust valve, Your Honor, but it says it in the context of the special purpose cam, the double bulk cam, which is similar to the Dynatar cam. And the Dynatar cam was with the exhaust brake, was tested by Matt Trott. We had testimony in the record from Mr. Picard, the inventor of the Dynatar brake, who said Matt tested a Dynatar engine brake with an exhaust brake with that particular cam, and you got no performance. In fact, you got the valve flicker. Mr. Jacobs has argued in Herculean, you always get valve flow. Mr. Picard testified that there was no such valve flow. Jacobs tested the diaphragm of the exhaust brake. They got no valve flow. They got reduced performance. Hackbrake itself tested the diaphragm with an exhaust brake, and we got none. So the district court correctly found that the fourth embodiment, which talks about using an exhaust valve, was not enabled.
For anticipation purposes.
But Jacobs does not appeal that finding. And what Jacobs has never done, and the district court never did, is okay, it's not enabled. Where does the prior art teach you to fix the problem? Or how to fix the problem? Jacobs sits here now, and they go, well, you could do this, you could do that, but the reality is, when they tested the Dynatar with the exhaust brake, they didn't put those fixes in. In fact, Jacobs tested the 3406 Caterpillar, which was the engine that Mr. Mealy worked on. They tested the combination, and they said, we don't recommend the combination because of the concerns for valve float. Valve float was it was something which the industry did not want. Mr. Meister tells you in his memo.
The district court found that it was tolerated by the industry.
It could be tolerated, Your Honor, as well, which is true. Some people would have a limit. Detroit Diesel, Mr. Meister, in his memorandum, which we cited to you, said TTRD, one of the largest engine makers, would not tolerate valve float. So valve float was one of those things that sometimes it happened, sometimes it didn't. They tried not to have it because of concerns for what could do to the engine, the turbocharger. It had all sorts of bad effects. So I see my light.
Mr. Baronato, yes, you used your rebuttal time. We'll restore the rebuttal time, give him 3 minutes, and then give Mr. Coyne an additional 3 if he needs to use it, all right? It keeps the time even. Mr. Coyne?
Thank you, Ron. Yes, please, the court. With me at council table is Mark Osterman and Chris Mead, who assisted with the trial below. Your Honor, there really are two fundamental issues here, and that is the claim construction of the supercharging and the claim construction on the but-for causation. I'd be happy to entertain any of the court's questions. But
yeah, well, you're going to have to start someplace else with me. Where does the trial court consider secondary considerations, even consider them?
It starts at page 51.
51. Well, no, that's interestingly the only place I could find in the opinion at all. And that is citing the Graham versus Deere.
Yes, sir.
It is not consideration of secondary considerations.
The court finds in enough he talks about valve float extensively in the 74-page opinion. It starts at page 13 and 14, goes to the 20. Discussions of pros of whether some engine manufacturers did not like valve float, others manufacturers like Williams were actively encouraging it. That there were plenty of people testing it. It continues to the discussion of pass rates, T37 rates. And he does not find commercial success, but he does find that it basically enabled pass rate to enter the market as an engine brake maker. So
that's setting forth the facts. That really isn't considering secondary considerations as an aspect of obviousness, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I think he did consider them. He doesn't articulate that expressly in the discussion starting
at all.
Well, Your Honor,
is that a problem?
No, Your Honor. It's in his findings very explicitly. The court had a 3-week trial, heard dozens of witnesses, and entered a number of findings on these points. And what he found is that the references are so clear. Okamura does have all the evidence.
What about the secondary concern? What was argued down below about the secondary considerations? The district court briefs or whatever that articulate these arguments are not in the record and not available. So what was argued? What did you argue about secondary considerations to the district court?
What we argued is that there was no commercial success because this brake enjoyed literally a T37. The pack rate's rate sold 1 brake a week for about a year. It may have been very significant to Mr. Neely. I don't want to denigrate that. But this is an objective standard.
Did you argue lack of nexus?
We did argue lack of nexus. And he didn't make an explicit negative finding on that, but he definitely did not find that the P37 was commercial success of the invention. What he said is that the P37 enables pack rate as a manufacturer of engine brakes. What was argued below was copying, long-felt need, failure of others, commercial success, and this teaching away on valve float. The opinion and the record is replete, and we put many of those sites in
our other than your arguments, did you submit any evidence showing a nexus between the secondary considerations and the feature?
We believe we submitted evidence showing that there wasn't a nexus. We had cross-examined Mr. Neely. During that cross-examination, he stated that, he had sold a brake a week. Keep in mind, there's different claims here. When you say commercial success of the invention, there's an invention of claims 2, 4, 9, 10, and 14 that requires the delay in the pressure pulse, delay in the timing, to cause a big enough pressure pulse that it's going to flow down the exhaust manifold and push that valve open, supercharge the cylinder, trap the charge, and get you increased retarding horsepower. There is no evidence that anybody on this record, that anybody had ever done that, and the court so found.
Well, the court seemed to think there was an invention here that just wasn't claimed in claim one and the other claims that were found to be obvious. And but it would have been a good thing to make some findings about the secondary considerations and the lack of nexus between commercial success and these other things and what was claimed in Claim 1 is opposed to what might have been claimed in Claim 1 but wasn't.
Well, Your Honor, that's the second category. The rest of the claims that simply require a combination achieving valve float for 1, 5, 6, and 9.
Yeah, but the question is, what are we supposed to do here? He should have made some findings about lack of nexus, right? But he, for some reason, he didn't do it, and which is what Chief Judge Rader's asking about.
Well, there was substantial argument by Thackeray that there was this nexus. What he did is not find the nexus in spite of all the evidence. He looked at all the evidence, heard all the testimony, and deliberately did not find it.
Do we need a sentence?
I'm sorry?
Do we need at least a sentence that says, no secondary considerations because no nexus, period?
No, what he found was that that this brake enabled Packrate as a manufacturer of engine brakes. He does not make any harm that there was commercial success of this invention. With respect to the first group of claims.
By the way, this case was around a long time, and a lot of that time was reexamination. What happened?
Well, Your Honor, it's been around since about 2 months after my youngest daughter was born, and she's now a sophomore in college.
That's the point. And 7 years of that was, or 6 years, was re-exam, and at the end of that, it was...
Then the case was set down for trial, more discovery was allowed, it was reset for trial, it was finally tried in 2007, to the bench.
But I want you to address the re-exam. It
yes,
evidently, for some reason, was upheld in kind of the point that Judge Dyke's making. There's an invention here, isn't there?
Your Honor, we're not on this appeal. We certainly don't agree, but we're not contesting on this appeal that there's an invention of delaying the timing sufficient to cause a pressure pulse and having that be the cause of the valve float to get you supercharging. That's the invention that they went into the patent office and argued to the examiner, and there's a graph that they provided as shown at page 25 of our brief.
And that increases the braking horsepower from 280 up to...
The comparisons in the brief are not really accurate because what Mr. Baranato is doing is comparing the 300 that we tested, the D37, with the 280, which is a combination brake, against the 280 that our engine brake alone got. There isn't evidence in the record of what our combination got to compare against the D37. So it's a little bit of apples and oranges. But there are two separate groups of inventions here. Combination plus Okamura discloses. And granted, we're not appealing the finding of non-enablement on this fourth embodiment. We don't need to. This Mitsubishi published a series of articles describing this whole power chart system. And Seiko, the next article in the series, expressly, specifically says it is satisfactory to substitute a Jake-style brake, which is figure 7, for the compression-release brake. That's the motivation. That's the teaching or suggestion. If the fourth embodiment doesn't work because the cam doesn't lift or attach the valve, no problem. Seiko specifically says you can use the Jake brake. Now, if that brake argument teaches away, we disagree. It doesn't. It specifically says it's satisfactory. And what they did is got a lower level of lift by putting in heavier springs. He didn't eliminate the lift. He didn't eliminate the valve force. He's still getting it.
In the reexamination, was the examiner applying a different claim construction to the district court? How do we know that?
We know that, Your Honor, from the figure that Packrate provided to the examiner, which is a chart that shows their interpretation of the claim. And what they, I'm trying to find this, it's in one of the briefs, Your Honor, I believe it's in their brief. It's this chart at page 13.
Of the blue brief?
Of the yellow brief. And this is the basis for Judge Schottney feeling that Packrate had argued for this additional factor of supercharging, trap charge, increased braking horsepower. When Packrate went to the PTO, they specifically argued to the examiner no increase in cylinder pressure. Now, the problem is with this is, in the PTO, you're supposed to get the broadest reasonable construction of the claim. I would think the district judge would not be doing that anyway, but let's assume that that broadest reasonable construction is somehow broader than what the district court did. That can't be. What Patrick did here is went in and argued super overcharging, increased strap charge, increased braking horsepower. Convince the examiner.
Where do I find that argued that?
Sorry, Ron?
Where do I find that it argued that before the examiner?
The argument was, it was ex parte because this is an old case. It's in the file wrapper. At the beginning of volume 3 of the appendix. Patrick's slides that they presented to the examiner begin at page 3206 and continue for 3217, where the same graph that I just held up with the court appears once again.
Now, give us that site again.
3206.
3206 to where?
To 3217. And, Your Honor, I will agree that the record is not abundantly clear that they went in and argued a different construction, but this is what they argued to the PTO, and this is how they got the case allowed under exam, by arguing supercharging, which Judge Schottky has specifically said is not in any.
What's the best example of their arguing supercharging?
The best example of their argument, Your Honor, would be this chart 3217. The way I interviewed the case, the only record we have is the papers they filed after the case. We were not permitted to take the case.
This wasn't inter partes.
Sorry?
This was ex parte.
It was ex parte. It's a very old application.
And this is some kind of a PowerPoint that you referred us to, isn't it?
Yes, it's a PowerPoint that they presented to Examiner Gibby when they were arguing on the reexamination. With respect to the claim construction the court did enter, Your Honor, we feel that it is abundantly correct. The specification is very clear. That, for example, with respect to the supercharging, this increased strap charge, the abstract says may. The specification, as you go through it, lists these various categories of invention embodiments, alternatives that we outlined in our brief. And the specification makes it very clear that the essence of the invention, this is at page 81 of the court's findings, and page 548, of the reference, which the patent at column 7, line 10, that the essence isn't supercharging, the essence isn't delay time, those are alternatives. The essence is simply the combination getting valve flow, which an exhaust brake and an engine brake such as Okubert and Seiko described does. The valve flow is inherent. It always happens when you're running near the rated speed at any reasonable pressure. The arguments that Patrick has made to the contrary are all based on extreme operating conditions, high altitude, the engine's off.
Did the court make formal claim construction findings?
Yes, Your Honor, it did. It had a hearing several years ago and issued a transcript of the hearing and a transcript of a phone call that followed the hearing in which the court gave those constructions. And those constructions were given at, it appeared in the record at 147, and 161 is part of the transcript where the constructions are given.
But there's no formal order, construction order?
No, Your Honor, there's not a separate claim construction order. You could ask for one, and Judge Schottky said that the transcript of the telephone call was suffice. Patrick never came back, any back to your question, Judge Schottky. Patrick never came back and said, construe near top dead center. We're giving a different construction. We cited in our brief the portions of the transcript where we raised this on the Rule 50A motion. Specifically, we raised the two claim construction issues. And with respect to the first, the court said, yes, that's what I ruled. Turned to the parties and said, isn't that right? And the parties agreed. He used that as the basis for his claim for his case management for the rest of the case. In particular, with respect to this but-for causation, there's a site at 1596-97 during the testimony of Fatberg's witnesses, where the court specifically said, I have construed the limitation in Claim 2 to mean that there must be sufficient delay in the opening of the first exhaust valve to cause valve flux. That's during their case in chief. And granted, transcript years earlier, but it's right there. He repeats it again at 1784 to 1785 when we raised it on the 50A motion and turned to the parties, and Mr. Baronato agreed that when this issue was raised earlier, he conceded. He didn't say, which is what I've been in the position of having to do at times with the district court judge, Your Honor, we accept your ruling, we'll be bound by it for this case, but we take exception with it and reserve our right to appeal. He didn't say that. He said, I agree. And then he asked, and then further he said, we both agree. So we do feel that there's been a waiver here. But in any event, the court should be very comfortable with these constructions. They are abundantly correct. The specification says it's an option, it's an alternative. The core is combination, getting the valve plug, and that's what Okamura and Sato teach. Your Honor, I see that I've expired on the time, so I would be happy to answer any further questions the court has. Otherwise, I'll reserve the rest of the time.
And just one comment. I do think your gray brief goes beyond the cross appeal and argues obviousness with respect to the claims that were found invalid, which I don't think is proper. But there it is.
Thank you.
Mr. Baronato, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the district court made numerous findings on secondary considerations of all favor factors. On the second one, our brief, number July 25, we made findings of unexpected results, failure of others, commercial success, copying. Unfortunately, he got to the obviousness analysis. He said about having to consider the secondary considerations, but then the memo is devoid of any application of them whatsoever. They're just ignored.
He's so you agree he considered them?
I agree he made findings. I don't agree he considered them because there's no indication that he considered them. He didn't somewhere say, well, I...
Well, if he made findings, he considered them, right?
Yeah, to that extent, but he did not consider them in the context of the obviousness analysis. He simply said, in the beginning of his opinion, he says, I make all these findings, or he makes all these findings.
Why would they be secondary considerations if he makes them outside of a obviousness analysis?
Well, he made the findings, and he made them as to these particular parts. He just didn't apply them when it came to obviousness for some reason. Much like this court recently had in the cyclobenzene case that we cited in our memorandum, and a couple cases recently. But I'd also like to address Mr. Coyne's argument about the claim construction of the re-exam, because frankly, I was at the re-exam here in the interview, and I'm outraged at what's being said. There was no discussion of supercharging. What they point to, we never raised supercharging. All we were showing there, the court's construction, which, by the way, was before the patent examiner, as the judge himself found in his decision, he says, included with the reexamination request were, quote, this was, by the way, provided by Jacobs. They filed the reexam request, so I know this flying under the radar. He said, included were excerpts from this court's claim construction. Jacobs gave him the claim construction. We didn't. They gave it to him when they filed the request. And the judge said open means open so that air would flow.
But it's not really clear from the re-exam what claim construction the examiner was using, right?
The examiner was using the PTO claim construction, as far as I was concerned. He was given the court's claim construction.
And rejected it.
I don't know what he did. At the end of the day, he agreed with us. He agreed with us. He had the court's claim construction, and he said, this invention is not anticipated, and it's not obvious. And he did that based upon the Okamura reference, which Jacobs is now arguing, and he did it based upon other references, including the Wright article, which they're arguing. And he said, this is an invention that's worth, that is entitled to what happened. He upheld the claim.
Did he have Sato and Power Card in front of him?
He had Power Card in front of him. He did not have Sato, which Jacobs didn't submit, by the way, but such an important reference. And their witness, Mr. Wright, testified that, in fact, Sato was cumulative of the other Power Card articles. It really didn't have anything.
Thank you, Mr. Baronato. Mr. Coyne, we're limited to claim construction at this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
There was a brief reference, so you can make your point.
The court has to make an independent decision on this issue. It's not bound, it's not spotless. Sure, it's influential to the examiner. We think they were flawed. The court has said...
Flaws in what?
In the arguments that were made to the patent office.
What does that have to do with the cross appeal?
sorry, Your Honor, with respect to cross-appeal, the but-for causation is Packrate's argument on our cross-appeal. We feel that that is the right construction. Under that construction, if that's taken away, and we're now on a cross-appeal with a different kind of construction, Okamura and Sato, specifically 5350 to 51, show that supercharging. Nothing shows the but-for causation. We're not appealing those. But with respect to the rest of the claims, it's at 5350 to 5351. I would be happy to entertain any further questions the court has. Otherwise, I'll continue the rest of the time.
Okay, thank you. The next case is...